This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The street gang problem hasn't gone away in Los Angeles, but my guest, Father Gregory Boyle, hasn't given up on the young people who've joined gangs. Boyle is a Jesuit priest who was the pastor of Dolores Mission Church from 1986 to 92, a church which serves a poor and predominantly Latino neighborhood in Los Angeles. Then he founded Homeboy Industries, whose mission is to find jobs for ex-gang members. It now runs 5 businesses of its own, including a silk screening operation, a landscaping service, and a graffiti removal service. Homeboy Industries also finds jobs for former gang members and ex-convicts in businesses that are willing to take a chance on young people at risk. Father Boyle has put his own life on the line, exposing himself to the crossfire of gang violence. 1 year ago, he found out that illness was putting his life on the line. He was diagnosed with leukemia, which he says is now in remission. I asked Father Boyle how the amount of gang violence has changed since he started working with gangs in the 80s.
I lived through, you know, that decade of death, which was sort of 88 to 98, and that was really so intense. And certainly since, you know, roughly 98 to the present, we haven't seen the kinds of gang-related homicides that we did during that period. But when I was, you know, when I began doing this work and when I was pastor of Dolores Mission, which is the poorest parish in the city and nestled in 2 housing projects with 8 very active warring gangs, that was intense. I mean, that was shootings every night, and I buried a lot of kids. I mean, I've buried 122 young people killed because of gang violence since 88. 88 was the first time I buried had to do one of those funerals. But there was a period of time in there when it was particularly intense and lots of deaths, and certainly 92 was the highest number of gang-related homicides in the history of Los Angeles.
I'm sure many of the young people you work with in your nearly 20 years doing this work are now parents, and some of them are probably grandparents. Have you kept up with many of the people who you worked with when you first started working with gang members?
Yeah, you know, partly because I'm a priest, I probably do more baptisms than just about anybody, and they're all homies, you know, and every Saturday is packed with baptisms. And so I'm very, you know, heartened and touched and humbled by the fact that they asked me to do them. And that's a nice kind of chapter for them to be able to say, you know, I kind of had lost my way for a while, and now I have a kid myself, and now I want to do it differently. And these are kids who often enough, you know, haven't had very positive experiences of being parented, and so this is new terrain for them. And so, yeah, I stay very much connected to them.
So keeping in touch with people who you work with when they were in gangs and are now long out of gangs, have you learned anything about what seems to reach somebody on a more permanent, life-changing basis?
Yeah, I think part of what really works is the personal connection, you know, where people feel like a sense of belonging. You know, I think that's what people experience at Homeboy Industries, the program I run. You know, community is the fullest, truest antidote to gangs. It really supplies, you know, a place where kids can truly become the truth of who they are. They can start to see that they are exactly what God had in mind when God made them. I mean, I had a kid who, like 3 months ago, came in, and he was 24 years old, released from Corcoran Prison. He was covered in tattoos. I don't think I'd ever seen anything quite like this. It looked like he'd been dipped in ink, you know, and he was, I don't think I had met him. Maybe I'd met him before when he was a kid at juvenile hall. But very significant that he stepped into my office, but his arms were covered in tattoos, his neck was blackened with tattoos, shaved head, covered in tattoos. But most prominently, he had these like 2 black devil's horns tattooed on his forehead. And he says to me, you know, I'm having a hard time finding a job. You know, I'm thinking, well, let's put our heads together on this one. And he says, you know, I've never worked in my life, you know, and he was 14 when he went in. And so I hired him at Homeboy Silkscreen, which is our biggest business and has the most enemies working together. They print shirts and do embroidery. And I sent him, I said, will you start tomorrow? Well, I called him the day after that. And I called the factory there, and I said, bring that new guy to the phone. And I said, Carlos was his name, and I said, how's it feel to be working? And he says, you know, it feels proper. I'm holding my head up high. He says, in fact, I'm like that guy on the commercial, you know, the one who walks up to total strangers and says, I've just lowered my cholesterol. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm not following this. And he says, yeah, after my first day of work, I was all tired and dirty, and I was on the bus. I couldn't help myself. I just turned to total strangers on the bus, and I said, I just got back from my first day of work. Just got back from my first day on the job. And I just think, you know, here was a kid who had, who in the world would hire this guy, you know? And I suspect the unsuspecting on the bus thought he was, you know, like he didn't belong to us, you know? But there's no question in my mind, watching this kid now, still working for us, it totally changed his life. It gave him a reason to get up in the morning. He feels like he's filled with a sense of dignity that he had never known before, and it came through work. And plus, he worked continues to work side by side with his enemies, and is able to put a human face on somebody who he used to shoot at or hate, and you know, and that's just huge.
Does he still have the tattoo on his forehead?
Oh, and he's removing them. We remove tattoos in our office.
In your office?
Yeah, we have our own kind of a room. We have a state-of-the-art laser machine, and we have 1,000 on our waiting list. We removed 1,000 tattoos last year. And we have a slew of doctors who volunteer their time. It's happening right now in my office. And they come in. It's very significant, you know, for a gang member to say, I want to have this removed, you know, is packed with meaning. And we're the only place around that doesn't ask anything of them. They don't have to do community service. They don't have to pay a little. It's a very costly procedure. It would cost them thousands of dollars if they did it elsewhere. But, you know, you have to wait. But we want to get them in real quick because we acknowledge it as the significant step that it is. And kids will forever say, lift up their shirt and say, you know, I want to get rid of this one. I used to say, you know, keep your shirt on. But then they say, you know, no one will see it. And they'll say, well, my son will see it. And I don't want him to. And that's good enough for me.
So what are some of the more original tattoos that you've seen removed over the years?
I don't think, some of them I can't say on the, can I say stuff? I don't know if I can say. There was one, an alarming one, which was sort of, if you can just say, expletive the world on his forehead. And that was just emblazoned. It was just filled his forehead. Yet another one who was having a hard time getting that McDonald's job. You
yeah,
know?
That's a real job killer. Yeah.
may I take your order, please? And yeah, so but then we erased it, you know, and you want to say everybody is a whole lot more than the dumbest thing they ever did. And without a question, you know, tattooing that on his forehead was pretty dumb. You know, I saw him a couple months ago, and it, you know, it's completely erased. He used to work in our bakery that burned down. And, you know, no one would have given that guy a chance ever, ever. And I was happy that we did, and that he, you know, is now on with his life.
What's he doing?
He was working as a security guard, actually at a movie studio.
So in addition to hiring people for the Homeboy Industries, you also send them out to job interviews for other businesses.
Yeah, nearly 1,000 jobs a month, a year are located. And that, you know, certainly that's not as high as we would like it to be relative to the need. We kind of put people most immediately in our businesses because these are kind of the not ready for primetime player, basically, you know, the folk who've been released from a detention facility and have no kind of soft skills or work ethic or been very familiar with what's required of you, you know, of you know, showing up on time and not missing and taking orders from disagreeable supervisors. We provide all that for free. So they learn how to do all that stuff so we can send them out.
If I were an employer, I'd be probably a little skeptical about hiring somebody with a record, particularly somebody who is a convicted felon. So what would you do to convince me to give it a shot?
Well, you know, like I give talks all over the place and I always say yes to being able to get up there and kind of plead my case. And you never know, you might have an employer in the crowd And you want people to kind of feel good about this kind of intentional hiring, where they can say, they can get up in the morning and say, I'm part of the solution in the city of LA because I've chosen to hire this guy, and I'm going to teach him everything I know. And, you know, I think that appeals to people. Plus, I think in the end, people can get it. You know, it's people make mistakes, and people understand the degree of difficulty really there is in kids in my community, you know, kind of navigating the treacherous waters of their lives and of their adolescence. And a lot of times people say, oh, so you give them a second chance. Well, you kind of want to say, well, who was it that gave them their first one? You know, these are folks who I stand in awe of what they have to carry. You know, these are folks whose burdens are more than they can bear, and they're kind of the most disparaged. And once you get beyond the fact that, you know, I think they always say the same thing, employers. They'll call me and say, wow, that was a really eager, good worker. You know, send me somebody else, you know.
When you say that these young people have burdens greater than they can bear, what are some of the burdens you're thinking of?
I just think, you know, I've never met a hopeful kid who joined a gang. So, you know that any gang member is really coming from a place of misery that's kind of intense, you know, and a despair that's dark and bleak. And the bleaker it is, the more that kid's going to act out. And so I just think they find themselves unparented and drifting and gravitating perilously close to a gang, and then they find themselves in it. And then, you know, before they know it, they have a record. And before they know it, it's been years since they've been formally educated. And then pretty soon it just becomes this dark place that you have to reach down and say, come on, you know, it's not a hole in the end, it's a tunnel, and trust me, there's light, and I'll walk with you till you get to the light. After such time, you can walk on your own. I mean, I grew up in the same city as these kids did, and in the gang capital of the world, and you know, I had wonderful family and terrific parents and opportunities, and there's no chance I ever would have joined a gang, but that fact doesn't make me morally superior to these kids who just simply have to carry more, deal with more, encounter more, and have more obstacles in their path than my life ever presented me with.
What are some of the things you tell young people before sending them out for job interviews?
Well, our job developers kind of do a lot of that stuff. You know, they kind of do the protocol and the kind of crash course on what to do and what not to do, and we have kind of a litany of, you know, who knew? You know, we had to tell them not to slug the guy, you know, or you know,
just like the critical supervisor.
Right. You know, I guess we neglected to put that in our, and that happened once. You know, it was because he thought he had been slighted, and it was just terrible. But it's never happened again. But it was very isolated. But you know, we kind of tell them kind of how to do it, and how to. And plus, we have for our core group, we have 100 employees and homies who work in all our different businesses, and we insist that they all go through a. We have a curriculum where we talk about everything from parenting to courtesy issues to anger management and coping skills. So we want them to leave the Homeboy Industries part, which is, you know, temporary, really with skills to be able to manage their lives, you know, in the regular kind of employment world.
One of the things you're proud of with Homeboy Industries is that members of rival gangs work together. What's it like early on when somebody is starting to work there for the first time, and for the first time, they're supposed to be getting along with rival gang members?
Well, they always say the same thing. You know, they want the job, and I say, well, I'm going to have you work over there at the silkscreen, and you have to work with these guys. And they'll always say, I'll work with them, but I won't talk to them. You know, they always say that. And, you know, you can just look at your watch and time it in a short order. They're talking to each other. I had these two kids, a kid named Youngster and another kid named Caesar Puppet, they called him, and they were enemies. I introduced Youngster to the silkscreen, and I introduced him, walked him around. They shook hands with enemies, and I thought, well, this is a good sign. Until he came to this kid Puppet, they wouldn't shake hands. They just stared at their shoes, you know, and I knew they were enemies, of course. I found out later this was a deeply personal hatred and hostility. And I told them at the time, you know, if you can't hang, if you can't do this, you let me know. I got a lot of other people who want this job. And they didn't say anything. 3 months later, Puppet found himself surrounded in a alley by 10 enemies. He was walking home from a little store, and they beat him badly, and they kicked him while he was down, and they kept kicking his head. They wouldn't stop kicking his head until finally he's lying there lifeless and is taken to the local hospital and was on kind of life support and brain dead, basically. I've never seen anything quite as horrible as this. His head was many times swollen. But during that 48-hour period before he was disconnected and I buried him, I got a phone call from this kid youngster who had worked with him for 3 months, and he said, "That's messed up about what happened to Puppet." And I said, "Yeah, it was." And then he said, "Is there anything I can do? Can I give him my blood?" And we both sort of fell silent under the weight of it, and I could hear him sort of, he started to choke back his tears, and he said, with great deliberation, "He was not my enemy. He was my friend. We worked together." And there was this, you know, I asked myself, does that happen all the time? Has that ever not happened? It's always happened. It always has.
Do you worry that kids will being weapons to work, you know, are they ever searched for that? Or would that be disrespectful and something you wouldn't consider?
Yeah, I mean, I suspect it's happened. I know we've had guys coming in to look for work, so not employees of mine. And I know they've been armed because someone will always flag it, say, "Hey, you know, Lefty just came in, he has a gun." So I'll call him in, and they know that it's a sort of a heightened disrespect of me, and they don't like to do it. Sometimes they'll, I've seen it happen where they'll park their gun somewhere and decidedly not choose to walk in with it. A lot of that, it's the great myth of protection. You know, I carry a gun for protection. And I always tell them, name a single time this has worked. Name a single time when a life has been saved because somebody has carried a gun. They won't be able to ever name that time. And I said, well, when we don't have time to talk about the number of lives lost or ruined because of a gun, it's a hard thing to reason with them. But certainly, you know, they know that that can't happen if you're an employee of mine. But there's a kind of a heightened sense of respect for the place, you know. They know what it stands for, and they, generally speaking, have they know how to be respectful in terms of not bringing weapons.
One of the rationalizations for not working, which has become almost a cliche, is why should I serve burgers at McDonald's when I could get paid a whole lot more selling drugs? How do you answer questions like that, and how much do you pay the workers at Homeboy Industries? Is it minimum wage? Is it above that?
No, we always pay higher than minimum, and we encourage employers. Sometimes they'll say, "How much should we pay?" And I say, "Well, pay, you know, a just wage." We try to approximate a just wage as much as we can, and then insurance and that kind of thing.
Health insurance?
Uh-huh, yeah. So we try to, you know, model that for our the prospective employers. But, you know, if you are utterly convinced that a gang member is a human being who has the same desires and kind of dreams as any human being, then no one would be surprised to learn that they, in fact, would rather have above minimum wage job rather than go out running up to a car and trying to sell crack. It has to do with kind of a sense of dignity and pride and nobility, and they want their kids to be able to say, you know, my dad drives a truck. And they're kind of deathly afraid of the kid reaching an age where the kid will say on the yard, "Well, my dad sells drugs," you know. And plus, walk around, look at the profile of most gang members who sell drugs. You know, they're not buying the house in the suburbs, you know. That money, as they will tell you quickly, you know, it's called dirty money, easy money, and it's not the same as clean money. You spend it differently. You kind of value it differently, and they'll all tell you that.
I'm sure that you feel frustrated because you can't reach every young person you reach out to. Do you ever feel like, you know, a young person is just beyond your reach, that they're just, you know, nothing's going to get through to them?
Because I've seen many, many kids who you kind of secretly say, boy, I'm not sure anybody will ever be able to reach this kid. And then I've watched the kid, you know, find the place within himself to kind of say, oh, I don't want any part of that anymore. So, I mean, but you do encounter sometimes serious mental illness and psychopathic behavior or sociopathic. But that's so tiny, and that's a small slice of this group. But mainly, I've been surprised many times by kids who you thought, I'm not sure this is ever going to work, and then it does.
Where does God, faith, religion come in your interactions with gang members? Do you talk to them about religion? Do you try to get them back to the church? Or is it about jobs and about straightening out their lives? And if they, you know, if they choose to learn more about religion, that's their issue?
Yeah, I think part of, I'm in 25 different detention facilities where I say Mass, so I'm mm-hmm. I'm talking to these kids, and I
You're a busy guy.
Yeah. Yes. So I try to explain, you know, the gospel to them at their level, you know, so I'm always telling stories about, you know, homies and kind of parables of homies seeing the light or not seeing the light, you know, and I primarily want to speak to them the good news that they're okay and that they're beloved, you know. And so that comes up certainly when they're not locked up and when they're in my office. But, you know, part of, I think, from my own Christian perspective, you know, Jesus isn't expecting us to sort of kind of constantly talking about or announcing a message. You know, his hope is that we become that message. You know, God doesn't want us endlessly to praise God for being compassionate. God is hoping that we will spend our time being compassionate. So, you know, I kind of want to live as if the truth were true, and I want to go where love has not yet arrived. And you want to choose to stand with the folks that God chooses to stand with. And in that action, you know, it's not about words. I mean, I think it's not about kind of, you're going to have to hear this message if you want a job here. You're going to have to sit down and hear my preachifying. I just don't believe in that. You know,
it's like the old mission model, you know, where you can get your free donuts and you can get your free soup as long as you come in and sing the prayers and, you know, listen to the service.
I mean, frankly, you know, I got visited by the Department of Justice, and I think they're, pursuing some kind of, you know, the whole faith-based kind of approach. And,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't know what they're, I don't know if I pleased them, you know, because they were asking, you know, how much do I talk about, you know, Jesus as their personal Savior? And I don't do it because I just think it's not appropriate to do it in that context. Do people want concrete help? I mean, I've been on panels with kind of born-again folks who, and with all due respect, who will say things like, I don't know why we're talking about economic justice and jobs when what we really need to be telling these kids is that Jesus is their personal Savior. And of course, you know, Noah would be more horrified by that perspective than Jesus. You know, he would say, what? What are you talking about? You know, this is about rolling up your sleeves and really walking with folks who are having a hard time. And it's about concrete help. It's not about inserting message in their earlobe. It's about somehow showing them that somehow imitating the kind of God you believe in, one who loves without measure and without regret, one whose joy it is to love us. You know, and pretty soon, you know, it's like the Zen saying, the finger pointing to the moon is not the moon. It just points to it. You want to be able to live a life that points to the moon, that somehow indicates to them the kind of God we have without preaching at them. You know, it's not about them listening to me anyway. It's about me listening to them, and in that action somehow conveying the deepest spiritual reality. I think all we are about is God and spirituality at Homeboy Industries. But it's the only reason to do it.
Could I ask you to tell a short Homeboy parable?
Yeah. I kind of used it. A homie who works for me named Robert called me on New Year's Day, and he said, Happy New Year's. And I thanked him. 20 years old, completely rejected by his family, had been living on his own in a crummy apartment, just barely making it. And I said, you know, I was thinking of you. How was your Christmas? Because this is during Christmas. What'd you do Christmas? And he goes, oh, it was just right here in my apartment. I said, by yourself? He said, no, I invited a couple of the homies that I work with who didn't have a place to go either, and these were enemies. I said, really? What'd you do? He goes, you're not going to believe it. I cooked a turkey. I said, really? You cooked a turkey? He goes, yeah. I said, well, how'd you prepare it? He goes, ghetto style. I said, well, I'm not familiar with that recipe. What's ghetto style? And he said, well, you rub it with butter, and I poured a gang of salt and pepper on it. Then I squeezed two limones with two lemons all over it. I popped it in the oven. It tasted proper, he said, which is a very gang expression. It tasted proper. And I said, wow, what else did you have besides turkey? And he said, that's it, just turkey. I said, really? He goes, yeah, the six of us just sat in the kitchen staring at the oven waiting for that turkey to be done. Did I mention that it tasted proper, he said. And I thought, for me, that's what it's about. It's about six vatos, you know, six gang members, enemies, no place to go, sitting in a kitchen staring at an oven waiting for the turkey to be done. You know, that's as sacred and as ordinary as the Last Supper, you know. I can't remember the context which I mentioned that, but that's an example of it's not really a story so much as an image of people hanging on to each other and declaring with unshakable certainty that we belong to each other.
Did you suggest a side dish for the next time?
I said sometimes
some
people,
potatoes to
sometimes,
go along with it.
Sometimes your guests actually expect more than just the bird. So.
Yeah.
But, you know, next year we may have something else. I'll try to expand his menu.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Father Gregory Boyle, and he works with gang members in Los Angeles. He founded something called Homeboy Industries, which gives jobs to many gang members and helps other gang members find jobs. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Father Gregory Boyle, and since the 1980s, he's been working with gang members in Los Angeles. He founded Homeboy Industries, which finds jobs for young people and also has several businesses that give jobs to young people. Well, something that's fairly new for you is you were diagnosed with leukemia, and thank goodness you're in remission now. You've had chemo. You're now in remission. But how did that affect the gang members when they found out that your life was in jeopardy? And these are people who put their own and each other's lives in jeopardy all the time.
Oh, it was a remarkably gracious period for me. I would not trade that moment for anything. I was diagnosed in, beginning of April, and I began chemo right away. And so it was out of the woodwork. The folks would come back. It was for 2 months, I had to just tell myself, this is now my ministry. My ministry is to allow these folks to come back, sit in my office, sob and cry, and they needed to tell me where I had been for them. And then it allowed me an opportunity to reciprocate. I remember getting a voicemail from a homegirl named China, where she said, now it's our turn to take care of you. Very sweet. And I remember a kid named Grumpy, big, huge guy, no neck and tattoos, standing in front of my desk, big tears in his eyes. And he says, what do I have that you need? You know, meaning organs, you know, not that I needed any, but I think it was the thought that counted, you know. My favorite one was a kid who called me not that long ago, collect from jail, a guy named, we call him Loco. And he says, what's this leukemia anyway? I said, well, leukemia, it's in the blood. My white count is too high. And he goes, "Oh, those doctors, they don't know anything." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, hello, of course your white count is high. You white." And it was an endless stream of this sort of joyous, tearful, wonderful kind of, it just absolute grace upon grace. And you know, they drive me to my chemo, because, you know, you're really not supposed to drive yourself. And so, you know, I'd have the graffiti crew, I'd hop in a truck and they'd drop me off. And just wonderful, you know, you know, and I'm feeling fine and everything, you know, and then it sort of triggered all these lifetime achievement awards from all sorts of organizations because apparently they thought I had reached my lifetime. So,
well, you were told always, that, weren't you? I mean, I read that you were given 5 to 6 years to live.
No, I don't know where that came from. I think the doctor would never told me anything like that. I think it came from just sort of my own study of, I'd be in a Barnes & Noble and I'd pick out a new cancer book and it would say, you know, prognosis, 5 to 6 years. And I think somehow that got repeated somewhere. And so it appeared in somewhere in the press or in LA Times here. So, you know, I suspect, you know, this will all come back again in a year is what he told me. And then I'll have to deal with it again, either with kind of another round of chemo or something. But right now I'm back at it. But it was a remarkably gracious time of, and it was good for kids to be able to kind of say, "Now you need to listen to this. You need to shut up and listen to this." They would say it like that, you know. And I'd had to kind of put on hold my life. I couldn't do all the work I needed to do because this was the work that needed to be done. They needed to come in and they needed to say that with great tears. And then it was consoling for them because I think when they heard cancer and they heard chemo, you know, they needed to come and kind of see me. And I think, you know, they could see I wasn't falling apart, and I'm kind of hair deprived anyway. So they always joked about, you know, chemo didn't take my hair because God had sort of done that prior to this. So
now, you've risked your life before. You've been in the middle of sprays of bullets, you know, just in the work that you do, working with gangs. So you know, you've taken your risks. You've come close to the edge, but this is a different kind of coming close to the edge. So how did you take the news that you had a potentially life-threatening illness?
Well, you know, I have kind of a light grasp on these things. I don't know why this is or even claim, you know, that this is some kind of superior way to be. It's just death is not on my top 10 list of things to dread. You know, I more often than not dread meeting payroll or that kind of thing or far sillier things. It just doesn't compute with me. And so I never had a moment of why me and oh my God. And it was just, you know, and again, I don't mean to portray that as overly noble or courageous. It just is not, it's not on, but you recognize that it is on everybody else's list. So they project onto you their great fears of mortality. And so you have to be sensitive to not to trivialize their anxiety about me.
Well, what about pain
though
and suffering? Where does pain, suffering, discomfort, where does that come in your list of dreads?
It just doesn't. I mean, I you know, I had a relatively, you know, good run with the chemo. I mean, I was telling people that on any given day I was one of the seven dwarves, you know, grumpy or sleepy or sneezy or I don't know if itchy is one of them, but he ought to be. And so I was, sometimes I was all seven of the seven dwarves at once. And that was it. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't more traumatic than that. Sometimes I just didn't feel good enough to come in and people gave me, you know, the room to do that. And other times I was at my desk or I cut back on some of my camps, you know, and jails because, you know, even now my antibodies aren't that high and my resistance isn't, their concern is I might get some, something that they won't be able to fight, you know, so I'm careful, you know, I cut back a little bit, but I'm back at it really now. And part of the thing is I've seen some of the most extraordinarily, heartbreaking, you know, sufferings of mothers losing their sons and mothers losing multiple sons, you know, just, you just can't wrap your mind or heart around the depth of that kind of pain. And I'm the luckiest man alive. I wouldn't trade my life for anybody's. And so I just feel like it just wasn't an issue, you know.
Have your prayers changed since you were diagnosed? And I don't mean, you know, kind of praying for good health, praying for things. But I'm thinking that sometimes prayer is a distraction from, a way of refocusing the mind away from self-attention or away from discomfort, away from one's own fears.
Yeah, you know, I kind of, stepping back from that, I have a healthy respect for kind of this force of prayer, which wasn't kind of it for me, you know, even the petitionary part. I mean, there were a group of women from the projects every Thursday night gathered in the church praying only because I had leukemia, and just powerfully gathering in large numbers of them. And that wasn't sort of ever on my prayer kind of radar, you know. I mean, for me personally to say, please, Lord, take this away from me. That's just not, my prayer is kind of more, somehow I want my heart to be the shape of God's, you know, and so I want to center myself in the heart of God and live from that heart. So that's all I care about in prayer, and I want to find myself one, you know. But I had a kind of a healthy respect for the power of people who prayed. You know, I don't fully understand that mystery, but I, you know, and those women have duly taken credit for the fact that I'm in remission. And I, you know, I say, yeah, I guess. You know, I think it's a wonderful thing that challenged me and encouraged me to kind of see a deeper side to prayer that I had sort of dismissed as just petitionary. But for me personally, I don't think it changed. It keeps you focused on today. And I always think of the desert monks centuries ago, whenever they were greatly distressed or despondent, really, they would just repeat one word over and over again to themselves. And the word wasn't Jesus, or the word wasn't love. The word was today. And I understand that mantra. I understand that it keeps you here. It keeps you facing the person who's facing you. It keeps you present to God revealed magnificently in front of you.
Before we have to wrap up, just to give us a sense of what your daily life is like, what's the agenda like today?
Mainly, like, by the time I get back, they always know what time I'm going to be there, so I'll be there from 1 to 5. So today will be just an absolute steady flow of folks, mainly who've been released from detention, who've called me and said, I just got out, and remember you gave me your card, and so I'll try to kind of facilitate that. And this afternoon will be packed with folks coming through because I've been out of town for a couple of days giving talks. And so it's a backup, you know, where they know that I'm going to be there, and so they'll be ready, hoping for something, the hope of something, you know.
Do you ever feel like there's too many people, you don't have enough time to give them each what they require?
Yeah, only every day, you know. So yeah, it's just, that's a constant one, and that's one where I need to always challenge myself and just say, I can only do what I can do. And I, you know, for me, my pivotal image is of a dream a kid had who saw him and me in a big locked room with no windows, pitch black, and we don't speak to each other. And in the dream, he says that I have a flashlight and I pull it out and I aim it at the light switch. No words are exchanged. And the kid says that he knows that in this dream, he knows that he's the only one who can turn the light switch on. He's deeply grateful that I happen to have a flashlight. And so in the dream, he walks over to the light switch, flips it on, and the room is filled with light. And as he's telling me this dream, he's starting to sob. And he says with kind of a great discovery, the light is better than the darkness. Like, he never knew that. And I just feel that frees me. I don't have to turn on the light switch for anybody, but I want to be able to shine the light so that that kid can do it himself, you know.
Well, a nice image to end on. Father Boyle, thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck with your work and good luck with your health.
Thank you, Terry.
Father Gregory Boyle works with gang members and former gang members in Los Angeles, where he founded Homeboy Industries.